The Ozarks at Large podcast is made possible by KUAF's contributing listeners. Support from individual listeners in our community helps pay for the cost of producing and distributing this podcast. If you'd like to support this podcast and other digital media produced by KUAF, you can make a contribution at supportkuaf.com.
This is 91.3 KUAF, your home for NPR News for more than 32 years. And this is Ozarks at Large. For Tuesday, September 5th, 2017, I'm Kyle Kellums. Later on today's show, before the printing press, everything was written by hand. This spring, an honors course seminar at the University of Arkansas examines the manuscript culture before and after Gutenberg. We'll talk with Joshua Byron Smith, who will head the seminar and deliver a public talk tomorrow on campus about the subject. First, a law that allows concealed carry on public university and college campuses in Arkansas went into effect Friday. But, just because you have a concealed carry permit doesn't mean you can now have a concealed carry gun on campus just yet. Your concealed carry license has to be upgraded first after taking an additional 8 hours of training. This is Arkansas State Representative Charlie Collins, who wrote the campus concealed carry bill.
But what I did not envision when I originally wrote the bill is that we would actually create a much bigger program which involves a new concealed carry license. We're calling it an enhanced permit.
That enhanced permit training that was added to Representative Collins' bill later is not available yet. So while the law went into effect September 1st, Arkansas State Police has an additional 120 days after that to create a training curriculum. Here is Representative Collins again.
So let's say they have their curriculum designed by the end of the year. Once that's designed, they obviously need to get that information out to the instructors. The instructors have to set their course schedules. They need to be able and be prepared to teach those courses. And then people need to be able to sign up for the courses, actually go through the courses, get the certifications back to the state police. They need to go through the administrative process of giving them the enhanced permit. Because until you actually are awarded an enhanced permit by the Arkansas State Police, you do not have an enhanced permit.
Representative Collins says that means if you are concealed carrying on campus before getting that enhanced permit, you'll be breaking the law.
My expectation is the first enhanced permits will be issued beginning in the first quarter of 2018.
And Representative Collins says it's the responsibility of the gun owner to know what they are and are not allowed to do under the new law. Campuses and businesses around Arkansas are preparing for the eventual gun law implementation. And as Arkansas Public Media's Sarah White's Coda Check reports, the state police do have those 120 days to create the curriculum.
John Fulbright is manning a table at a gun show on a Sunday afternoon at the Arkansas State Fairgrounds. He's selling guns and holsters for people who want to hide what they're carrying.
Some people like the appendix carry, which is carried in the front. Some people carry at the 3 o'clock position, sometimes maybe back to the 5 or 7 o'clock position. It's just what's comfortable for that person. They carry inside the waistband, outside the waistband.
He teaches a 5-hour mandatory course for concealed carry permits at Shooters University in Cabot. Now the state is developing an advanced permit for people who want to carry on college campuses, sporting events, and private spaces like churches. J.W. Jones is considering getting the advanced permit. He's a 33-year-old car mechanic and thinks he might use it at work.
I don't want to be in a situation where somebody's there shooting and somebody I'm friends with or somebody I care about gets shot or I get shot and nobody's there willing to stop them.
State Representative Charlie Collins sponsored the law. He says fear of someone like Jones packing under their clothes might stymie a plan.
If these crazy killers, who are crazy like a fox when it comes to planning and plotting the murder of our loved ones, if they have to fear that somebody else might disrupt their plans at the beginning, then I believe some of them will say, this plan will not work.
State police are charged with coming up with the class. Collins hopes it will teach permit holders how to let the police know that they are not the attacker.
Set your weapon down. Announce that you have a weapon. Point out the wounded, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas the criminal shooter, the murderer, is very likely to point his weapon at the police and start shooting at the police.
Cassandra Kerfasi is a faculty member at the Center for Gun and Policy Research at Johns Hopkins University. She says evidence shows that most mass shooters target people or places they know, and concealed carriers won't discourage that.
I think the best available research shows that guns on college campuses are not a good idea.
In fact, they may escalate violence in general by giving criminals more reason to pack a gun. And she says most people aren't skilled enough to tackle a moving shooter. They are more likely to hit another victim.
Everything changes when you're in a crisis situation. Your heart rate's up, you know, your eyes dilate, you've got all this these stressors and loud noises, and often only a few seconds to decide, shoot, don't shoot.
Grafasi says data shows even police officers hit only about 30% of their practice targets. But Colin hopes Arkansas's training class will serve as a model compromise for safety. Fulbright says he'll plan to ask carriers to think about what might happen after they shoot.
You're going to have to call 911. What do you tell them? Who do you talk to? Making sure they get an attorney. It's not something you want to try to do on your own. Be prepared to be put in the back of a police car for a while. Be placed in handcuffs. That's something a lot of people don't really think about. And your body's going to go through a lot of different things emotionally, and you just need to be prepared for that.
With school starting up this fall and the training program still in the works, armed students aren't likely to walk campus corridors until sometime next year. Sarah Weitz-Kotacek, Arkansas Public Media.
Arkansas Public Media is a journalism collaboration including Arkansas's public radio stations. You can find out more at the Facebook page for Arkansas Public Media. Still to come on today's Ozarks, with the ability today to communicate with thousands, millions, or even billions instantly, it's worth remembering there was a time when written communication was very different. Everything copied by hand.
The authorial copy is actually the one that's the least read. And let's say the copy that you've messed up and put things in and improved and made better is the one that ends up being the most popular. So then what would you want to read as a student in the 21st century? The one that's quote-unquote most accurate, or the one that was the one that was most widely read?
The legacy, culture, customs, and politics of the manuscript, ahead on today's Ozarks at Large.
Support for 91.3 comes from Arcom Plus, providing digital and offset printing, graphic design and promotional items, and a variety of business services for jobs of all sizes. Located just off College Avenue at 461 East Township in Fayetteville, Arcom has been locally owned and operated for over 25 years. Printing NWA.com or 444-7711. Feed Communities and UAMS would like to remind you that health is a gift you can give year-round. One in five families in Northwest Arkansas is food insecure, and local food pantries need your healthy donations all year, not just during the holidays. Feedcommunities.org for a list of healthy food donations as well as places to give. Walton Arts Center welcomes Old Crow Medicine Show to Baum Walker Hall November 16th. The Grammy-winning Americana band will be performing their newest album, 50 Years of Blonde on Blonde, in its entirety. Tickets go on sale this Thursday morning at 10 a.m. More information at waltonartscenter.org or 443-5600.
Salman Rushdie has set his novels all over the world. For his latest, he wanted to tell a story about his adopted home, the United States.
The subject of reinvention of the self is completely central. People come through Ellis Island and change their names. People move from the Midwest to the big city.
I'm Ari Shapiro. We talk with Salman Rushdie about his new book, The Golden House, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today, beginning at 3 on 91.3. After a break, Congress is back in session beginning today. There is plenty of work to be done, addressing the debt ceiling, considering tax reform, perhaps rethinking health care once again, and more. During the recess, Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton sat down with Roby Brock from our partner, Talk Business and Politics, to discuss these items and the continuing conversation regarding Confederate monuments.
A lot of explosion on the front centered around race and race relations here since the Charlottesville incident a couple of weeks ago. And it has centered a new debate on this need or purpose for having Confederate monuments in the South in particular. Do you think that debate is one worth having? Do we need to talk about what these Confederate monuments symbolize? Do they motivate these contemptible little men, as you called some of the white supremacists
The former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, I thought, made a good point, is that it's good to have our history in front of us. The Civil War was the worst war in American history. More Americans died in that war almost than every other war combined. And that's something that we should never let the next generation of Americans forget, nor should we forget why we fought the Civil War. It was to vindicate the founding promise of America that all men are created equal and they're endowed by God with equal rights, no matter their race, their sex, or any other thing.
It did lead to the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments.
So. Yes, right. Which in their own way are the most enduring monuments of the Civil War. As Abraham Lincoln said in the second inaugural as well, this is not something that the South did alone. This was something that America had done, and that he viewed the Civil War as something that America had to go through together, that both the North and the South had to take responsibility for what had happened through the sin of slavery, and that was the basis for a just and lasting peace and reunification of the country. So I think it's appropriate to have the debate about these monuments. I think it's best had at local levels in our cities, in our counties, in our states, rather than trying to impose a one-size-fits-all approach. True. And I think that there are certainly grounds for discriminating and distinguishing between types of monuments or the people to whom you build those. Robert E. Lee was a great general who made a bad mistake. He went on to help promote reconciliation and peaceful reunification, for instance. There are other people who were in the Civil War who could not make that claim. So I think it's appropriate to have those kind of debates. I don't think it's healthy to try to paint with a broad brush or to take these monuments down in the middle of the night or for vandals to go out and destroy them either. I think the healthiest thing in the long run is to let a democratic debate proceed and let peoples decide what they want to do, whether that's at the city, county, or state level.
All right, we'll watch as that unfolds. All right, I'm gonna do some quick hits here, so you gotta speak in sound bites at this point.
I'm a senator,
time,
I'm gonna give you long answers.
I know. a bunch of things on the congressional agenda when you guys come back. 30 seconds or less, what's gonna happen on healthcare?
I don't know what's going to happen on healthcare, to be honest yeah. with you. Obamacare is not getting better, and we're going to have to revisit healthcare. That may not happen next month. It may not happen the next 4 months, but too many Arkansans are still going to pay premiums that are increasing and losing access to their doctors. So that may be more targeted, specific reforms to try to bring down the cost of insurance for Arkansans. But trying to repeal Obamacare as we did over the summer is not going to be on the immediate agenda because it was clear that we didn't have the votes to do so as much as I would like to have done so.
30 seconds or less. What's going to happen on taxes when you get back?
I think we'll get a tax bill passed.
What will it look like?
Hopefully it'll look good for Arkansas businesses and families. Put a little more money in the pockets of Arkansas families at the end of the month and at the end of the year, and make it easier for our businesses to comply with the tax code and spend more money on their employees and on their customers as opposed to spending it to Uncle Sam.
Debt ceiling, 30 seconds or less. What's going to happen on
that? Well, the debt ceiling will be increased. I hope it's increased with some kind of accompanying reforms to our budgeting and our spending processes.
Will you vote for it either way?
I'll wait and see what the final legislation looks like. But
maybe.
The debt ceiling has frequently, in recent times, been an occasion when you can adopt reforms that hopefully result in spending a little bit less and spending taxpayer dollars more wisely. That's what I would like to see.
Senator Tom Cotton talked with Roby Brock from our partner, Talk Business and Politics, during the congressional recess. You can hear more from that conversation and read about other Arkansas news at talkbusiness.net.
On the next Fresh Air, John Le Carré, who's written a new spy novel about the protege of Le Carré's most famous spy, George Smiley. Smiley was also in Le Carré's novels The Spy Who Came In From the Cold and Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. Le Carré was a spy before writing novels. He learned about deception from his father, who was a pathological liar. Join us.
Fresh Air at 11 a.m. and 6 p.m. every weekday on 91.3 KUAF.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation.
Public radio's journalists play an essential role in your day. From Morning Edition to Here and Now to All Things Considered, you get the headlines, analysis, and insight into the day's events from their hard work, work they would not be able to do without the support of listeners just like you. Your gift to KUAF during September helps us pay for the programs you rely on every day. Make your gift during KUAF's fundraising month and keep this important journalism on the air. You can give at supportkuaf.com.
If you wrote something today, something longer than, say, could fit onto a notepad, there's a very good chance a keyboard was included. And if you wanted more than a couple of people to see what you wrote, there's a very good chance the process of sharing your message was done with technology. For centuries, that wasn't the case. Written communication had to be done exclusively by hand. Next spring, an honor seminar surrounding manuscript history will be led by Joshua Byron Smith, an assistant professor of English and the director of Medieval and Renaissance Studies program at the University of Arkansas. Tomorrow evening at 5:15, he'll deliver a public talk previewing next semester's seminar. And tomorrow's talk is open to the public and free in the Gerhardt Hall Auditorium. In advance of his public talk, we asked him about the study of manuscripts. He says he's most interested in what he calls manuscript culture.
That is an intellectual culture in which writing and dissemination and thinking all occurs through manuscripts, through handwriting, not necessarily the printing press mechanical reproduction, or now you're probably more likely to compose on Microsoft Word or on a computer than you are to write longhand on a legal pad, although some people still do that. So I think that was, you know, in my seminar, that's going to be the primary focus, what it means to have manuscript culture. And there's a lot of differences between manuscript culture and print culture. One of the primary ones is, let's say you want to write a work. So you sit down and you write your poem or your historical treatise or whatever you want to write, and you have to write it by hand or dictate it to a scribe who's going to write it by hand. And then you may look it over and say, okay, this looks pretty good, make some corrections, and then give it to another scribe to copy. And then you send it out to the world, and you have no control what happens over that, right? So in manuscript culture, there's no authoritative text. That is, there's no thing you look for and say, this is the right copy. Everything is going to be exactly the same.
Right, because if you have composed something and your scribe took it down and then I see it and I decide to copy it, I could alter it either intentionally or unintentionally.
Absolutely. You could introduce errors. You could say, I don't know this word, and kind of fudge it. You could skip a line. You could misread handwriting from an earlier period. It could be in a dialect of a language you don't quite understand, but you think you do. And so you can introduce all kinds of errors. Or you could be a little more invasive. You could say, I don't like what this says here about so-and-so. I'm just going to get rid of it. Or this isn't quite right. I'm going to put the right name of this king in. Or that's not what this means. That's not what this biblical passage means. This is what it means. And so an author has no real control about the dissemination of his or her work. It just kind of goes. And so you see this frustration sometimes. Geoffrey Chaucer has a poem where he gets really mad at his scribe, Adam. He says, you mess up my work and I have to correct it, so please get it right. So it can be a real problem.
Yeah, when you're talking, I'm thinking about all the great figures who would have only had access to writing down by hand or a scribe before Gutenberg. I mean,
right. I mean, Dante, Chaucer, all of the classical poets you think of, Virgil, Horace, the Homeric poet, everything is like that. So
that's really interesting. And then, of course, it's never quite the same, even if the words are, because if someone else has written it.
Right, exactly.
There are no two identical works.
Exactly. So the visual, even if they get all the words absolutely correct, the visuals are going to look different. It's not going to be the same words on each page. The book may be larger. It may be smaller. It may be written in a different script. And you can have a very fancy, nice-looking, high-level script. And then you could have like a very difficult, grungy kind of script. And that makes a big difference. If you're picking up a work and it looks like it's supposed to be special, you may say, oh, yeah, this is high quality. And then the same thing may look kind of low class, to use that term, in another manuscript copy. So that can really change your interpretation of what you're reading.
Any idea how often a work might have been copied? I mean, were there the equivalent of bestsellers?
Oh, yeah, for sure. So to give you some numbers, it depends. So we have hundreds of thousands of medieval manuscripts, probably more than that. You can't count them. There's so many. And so different works are going to have a lot of different copies. So the Bible, which is a complicated topic to talk about in the Middle Ages, 12th and 13th century kind of Bibles that have all the books of the Bible and kind of resemble our Bible. There's, you know, I don't know, a lot of copies of that, mm-hmm. hundreds of thousands, I don't know. Psalters, other liturgical texts, missals, antiphonals, there's going to be lots of copies of those. But to stuff that I tend to teach. So there's a very popular 12th century work called Geoffrey of Monmouth's History of the Kings of Britain that has 218 surviving copies, which is a lot. Geoffrey Chaucer has around 40 or 50. And
so of the Canterbury Tales? Or?
Yeah, copies of the Canterbury Tales. That's all the medieval copies that survive, yes.
Can you tell if one was perhaps like actually dictated by Chaucer or written by him? Or
yeah, that's a thorny question. Sometimes we have what we call autograph copies, so we know it's actually in the author's hand. So we get this with Aquinas. Thomas Aquinas has some autograph copies. There are lots of academic arguments about how close a manuscript is to the actual author. Sometimes it's very close. An author you may have heard of is Bede, who's a very important early medieval historian. And we have two manuscripts that are really close to his time period. And he's writing a long time ago, 1,300 years ago. Okay, so so those two manuscripts have a lot of authority when it comes to, you want to read the text, you may want to read what is closest to the author. But what I like about this class is that raises an interesting point. What if the authorial copy is actually the one that's the least read? And let's say the copy that you've messed up and put things in and improved and made better is the one that ends up being the most popular. So then what would you want to read as a student in the 21st century? The one that's quote unquote most accurate, or the one that was the one that was most widely read? So it's a difficult question to answer. I mean, both really, right?
So fake news didn't originate with social media.
Yeah, fake books, fake authorship. So this kind of intellectual culture, and there's lots of different terms for this. One French critic has called this mouvance, and he says this is a thing to be joyful about, because it's kind of cool. You can see, oh, they're reading a manuscript, a work, this particular way in England in this monastery, and they're reading it a very different way over here in France. And that is a neat thing. And medieval people don't have this, what we may say, an archaic yearning for some kind of, this is the absolute perfect manuscript, this is the perfect copy. There is no perfect copy. They know there's not a perfect copy. So.
But of course, dissemination of information or the spreading of information would have been much slower. I mean, I don't know how long it would take someone to transcribe or copy the Canterbury Tales, but you're not doing it overnight.
Yeah, so we have lots of information about that, and it depends. You could copy a text really fast if you had a professional scriptorium. You don't have to have one person copy one text. You can split it up. And you can say, we're going to divide this work into 10 parts. Okay, Kyle, you copy part two.
Oh, wow.
And then your friends copy part three. And that is your professional job. And so you can put out a copy in a week. One of the neatest things is that after the printing press was introduced, you would think that manuscript culture and making manuscripts would just die immediately. And that's not true. It never really died, but it continued quite vigorously for a long time, and that's because operating the printing press is actually pretty difficult to do too. You have to set the type, you have to get a team of people. And so if you have, let's say you have a treatise against this particular king and you want to make 50 copies and it's the year 1550, you may well just say, actually the cheaper and the fastest route is to have a team of scribes copy this by hand rather than pay a printer that has to do all that. And so you have to do your calculations. A big book like the Bible is probably going to be faster once you set up the printing press. But smaller things, sure. And these are professionals, right? This is their job. And so they can do this with some speed.
Literacy plays a part then. Or did it for a scribe? Could you just do it by eyesight? Or?
Oh, that's kind of a vexed question. Usually we assume that if you're copying a text that you know, let's say Latin, if you're copying a Latin text. But we have so many cases where there's scribes with poor Latin but maybe a pretty hand. And, you can tell they don't quite know what's going on because they're messing stuff up here and there. So it's not even a safe assumption to say if somebody is copying, they're 100% what we may say fluent in Latin, let's say. So you get these weird moments where, you may be copying, or you may be an artist who is not is not literate, let's say, but you are an amazing artist, and so you may be called in to illuminate a particular manuscript. So you had a role in making this book, but you're not literate. So,
any idea if there was backlash against the printing press, like there has been against television or Facebook?
Yeah, people. Like any kind of technological change, switching to the internet, let's say, people got upset. You can find funny little diatribes against the printing press, kind of the mechanization of knowledge, and some people get a little iffy about disseminating knowledge, you know, so widely. But as a whole, this is a big question. What did the printing press change in the 1440s and what did it not? And so depending on who you read and when you're reading this question, you're going to get different answers. Some people will say, actually, not much. And other people say, no, it changed everything. And so the truth is probably somewhere in the middle. But again, the two cultures operated together for a long time. And so it's not quite easy to say, yeah, there is a backlash, but also it's not, you know, when a big change is happening, you may not notice it, right? You know, so I'm not sure. I mean, they notice it, but also they don't, because early printed books are made to look exactly like a hand manuscript. And if I showed you a page from a Gutenberg Bible and then another page from a Bible in the 1430s, I'm pretty sure you wouldn't be able to tell the difference. It's an exercise I do with my students, and very often they say, I don't know which one's printed and which one's not, because they look the same.
If I, in printing, or you, writing cursive, want to write something, we go somewhere and we get loose leaf paper or something. I mean, the paper's just there. That wasn't the case in 500.
Yes. So this is a great question and one my students really like. So what is your writing support? That's the technical term we use for a manuscript, a writing support. So early on in the Middle East, you'll get clay tablets, cuneiform. You get in the Mediterranean, papyrus was very popular early on. Papyrus is made from, papyrus makes paper. And so it's basically a papyrus plant pressed together. And it works really well if your climate is dry. But if you're not in a Mediterranean climate, papyrus does not last very long. And so for Northern Europe, papyrus and paper is really not much of an option. They can make paper in the Middle Ages in Northern Europe, and they do, but it's not. They made it out of leftover cloth for the most part, but it wasn't really effective because it would just kind of deteriorate and get wet. And so they used parchment. And parchment is basically animal skin. And so Western knowledge has come down to us on the back of animals, quite literally. Now, do you want to know how to make parchment?
Sure.
Sure. Yeah.
I doubt I'll never do it.
It's kind of a messy process.
Okay.
So you have your, let's say, you usually use cow, but in Italy you can use goat, and you can actually use all kinds of different animals, but they use cow a lot. And so you take the skin of the animal, and you dip it in this kind of substance that loosens the hair, a lye substance sometimes, and then you hang it up and you scrape the hair side off, and then you do it again and you scrape the hair off again, and then you scrape the flesh off and you try to get it as smooth as possible. You put it on a loom-like thing and you let it dry, then you scrape it again, and then you may wet it again and scrape it. And so there's varying grades of quality. Some people like you can have a manuscript that's not been processed very well, and so that would have been cheap parchment. And then you can have very fine, very thin parchment. And you can tell the difference. I should have brought a piece of parchment with you. We call it the hair side or the flesh side of the page, and it feels different. The hair side feels a little suede-y, kind of like felt, and the flesh side feels smoother. So
would you write on both sides?
You can write on both sides. Yes, they make it to where you write on both sides. And and then once you get that, you can cut it and make, you know, do you want a big sheet? Do you want a small sheet? I'm skipping lots of stages, but
sure.
Then you basically bind it. You can bind it together and make a little booklet, and then you bind the booklets together and make kind of a book with an outer cover, which is also bound in leather usually and some board, some woods. So it's a messy process, and there's great YouTube videos. There's people who still know how to do this, and you can look it up. I have one YouTube video I really like just to see the sheer amount of labor that goes into making one piece of parchment.
either in the honors, the signature series seminar that you'll be doing in the spring, or at this public discussion that you'll have as a preview that's open to the public, will you have examples? Will you?
Yes, our library has a handful, probably a little over a dozen now, medieval folios. So a folio is one page of a manuscript that's been broken, and I can talk about what that means in just a second. It's kind of interesting. And we've acquired this collection in the last 5 years or so, and we use it as a teaching to teach this kind of stuff. So I will bring my students into special collections, and we'll look at these and talk about all the stuff that I've been talking to you about. We have one leaf that I really like for teaching scribal error, which is a biblical leaf, and the scribe has left out a list of Hebrew names, and then another scribe has written in the margins, "Hey, just so you know, there's a list of Hebrew names that's supposed to be here, but it's not." Oh, wow. Another, a later scribe. So you can kind of see this
editor's
process.
Note.
Yes, an editor's note happening. And some of the folios, you can feel the difference between the hair side and the flesh side. Other ones, you can see, you know, animal veins in the manuscript. So we will have those on display. And also, they're open to the public. If you just go to our special collections library, our librarians would be very happy to show you the collection. You may be thinking that these things are fragile because they're so old, but they're not. If parchment is taken care of very well, it will last a long, long time. So it's much better than, let's say, 19th century paper, which if you've looked at a 19th century book and you open it, it can kind of crumble. Mm-hmm. Parchment, when it's taken care of, lasts a very long time. So you can pick these up and handle them. And I don't know if I can say this on the radio yet, but I think we'll have a big announcement about medieval manuscripts in the near future.
Whoa.
So that is something for
okay.
you. That's a little
right.
tease there. and I don't know if I'll be able to talk about that at the event, or if we'll have to wait a little longer. I'll have to talk to the library about
okay.
that. But yes, the answer is yes, there will be that we do have actual medieval material.
White gloves, right?
No, actually.
What? I thought
yeah.
the oil in my fingerprints or whatever would...
No, that's so there's a lot of discussion about white gloves or not white gloves when you're handling medieval manuscripts. In my work, when I go look at a medieval manuscript, especially in the UK, I almost never am asked to wear white gloves. And the thinking is twofold. It's one, it's parchment. It's not paper, so it likes the oil from your hand.
Mm.
And two, and this is actually something that is true, the white gloves can make you catch pieces of parchment and rip them off, whereas they're not going to catch on your finger. And so you're more likely to damage, to inadvertently kind of rip a manuscript or damage something that's already been damaged more if you're wearing gloves.
Joshua Byron Smith is an assistant professor of English and the director of Medieval and Renaissance Studies program at the University of Arkansas. In the spring, he'll lead an honors seminar open to students in the University of Arkansas's Honors College about manuscripts. And tomorrow, from 5:15 to 6:15 p.m., he'll deliver a talk open to the public in Gearhart Hall Auditorium on the U of A campus. That lecture is free. And next week on Ozarks, we'll highlight another honors seminar, this one about the global impact of soccer.
I get a call. But I know the truth. You see, the handwriting is on the wall. Just looked up and read it all. You're getting ready to call it all.
It is Tuesday, September 5th, 2017. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me is Becca Martin Brown, features editor at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette. We are full on into September. And the Clothesline Fair has happened. Football has happened. We're looking
this
at autumn.
This means now we run.
Yeah.
As if we don't run in the summers anymore.
And
but now
we're going.
We run. So it's always interesting to just pick up the phone and call an icon, right?
Sure.
They know you're going to call.
Yeah.
But you never know what you're going to get. So 2 weeks ago, I picked up the phone at the ungodly hour of 8:30 in the morning here.
You are not a morning person.
Really?
I'm just pointing that out to folks. Yes.
So it's 9:30 Eastern time, and the person I'm calling is saxophonist Branford Marsalis.
Indeed an icon.
Who's sitting in a barber's chair
mm-hmm.
and laughs when I ask him and says, oh, it's not for a haircut, but to get his head shaved. It's the only dignified thing to do when you only have half a head of hair. Okay. Yeah. I read several interviews with him because I don't really understand jazz. Mm-hmm. I still don't understand jazz. But I wanted to know what he thinks because I've talked to some of his brothers. He's the oldest.
Right.
Then yeah, when?
It's New Orleans musical royalty.
Yes.
Because they're all offspring of Ellis.
Right. And I had talked to, I think he's the next to youngest, DeFeo, mm-hmm. who we had a really interesting conversation because they have a brother who's autistic.
Right.
And so we talked about that. And he was the closest in age to that brother, so had the most interaction with him. Branford's enough older that by the time the other kids were old enough to be interesting, he was gone. He and Wynton went to New York to make music. He takes everything fairly seriously. Well, like you don't get him to cut up on the phone.
Here's the thing. He's a band leader. Mm-hmm. And I just think I think band leaders have to be serious.
Maybe that's it. He talked about acting, that he had a high school teacher that wanted him to become an actor. And he's had roles in movies, but he says, that's not acting. They just give me a character name and I'm still me.
Right.
And he talked about moving to New York. Well, first he talked about going to D.C. He thought he was going to be a politician because he wrote an essay in the 70s and he got to go to D.C. Mm-hmm. He thought he might do that. He really didn't intend to be a musician. And when he did move to New York with his brother, he went back to studying plays that were recommended to him by his neighbor, Lawrence Fishburne.
Oh, there you go.
So I got some good stuff out of him, but he was a hard interview. I think he'll be a great concert because he says he doesn't believe in the making jazz so innovative that nobody knows what you're doing.
Sure.
He says it's a conversation, and you don't call that innovation. You just call it a conversation. So I think it'll be a fun performance. He opens the UAFS Season of Entertainment at 7:30 on Thursday at the ArcBest Court Performing Arts Center. Tickets start at $32. And I'm guessing by this point you can get one or two seats together, maybe.
Call now.
Also this week, there's a Full Moon Kayak Tour.
Oh, on what they say, they being Hobbs Bay Park, is a calm part of Beaver Lake under the full moon.
Right.
Weather permitting, all that.
Right. No. But they provide the kayaks, the paddles, and the life jackets. Can I have three of those, please?
Right.
At 7:30 tonight, and it's $6 for kids and $12 for adults. You need to register at 789-5000. Tomorrow, from 4 to 5, one of the special exhibition tours at Crystal Bridges Museum involved in the wrapping up of the Chihuly exhibit, the Chihuly in the Forest tour. You need an exhibition ticket for it, and that starts at 4 o'clock. And then at 6 o'clock, there's a talk at the Fayetteville Public Library with Diane Burko, whose art has been at the Walton Arts Center.
She's a wonderful person.
And she will be talking about her book, Glacial Shifts, Changing Perspectives, Bearing Witness to Climate Change. Then Thursday night, it's First Thursday.
It sure is.
So there's a book signing at the Bank of Fayetteville on the Square hosted by Nightbird Books, and it's called Arkansas Sports Night.
Oh, is my friend Evan DeMorel going to be there?
Yes, he is. And Brian Randall and J.B. Hogan from 5 to 7 o'clock.
Perfect.
There's an artist reception at the Fayetteville Underground for Robin Horn, who mm-hmm. is a sculptor and painter. Mm-hmm. And there's an artist reception at Stage 18 for an artist named Joel Armstrong, who works in Rust. Pretty fascinating.
Okay.
And that happens from 6 to 9. So if we told you we were off and running, have at it.
Here we go. Becca Martin Brown, features editor at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette.
I'm Magna Chakrabarty. President Trump called the North American Free Trade Agreement the worst trade deal ever signed, and he said he'd pull the U.S. out of NAFTA. Renegotiation talks are underway, so how's it going?
Things are tough because you cannot be in a table negotiating a deal that the other side doesn't want to be in.
That's next time on Here and Now.
It's ahead from 1 to 3 on 91.3.
From Little Rock,
I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs. Louis Thomas Moondog Hardin Jr. was born in Marysville, Kansas, May 26, 1916. The son of an Episcopal minister, the family moved around the Midwest. Attending an Arapaho dance in Wyoming and getting to play the tom-tom at a young age fostered a lifelong affection for Native American rhythms. As an adult, he performed with the Blackfoot tribe. Hardin lost his sight in his early teens from the explosion of a dynamite cap in Hurley, Missouri, where Hardin played drums in the school band. In the early 1930s, the Hardins lived in St. Louis, and he attended the Missouri School for the Blind. Hardin's father became the rector of St. Paul's in Batesville in May 1936. The family moved to nearby Moorefield. Hardin took piano lessons from local teacher Bess Maxfield. He became known for wearing capes and long hair. In 1942, Hardin got a scholarship to study music in Memphis. Late the next year, he moved to New York City and got to meet Toscanini and Leonard Bernstein. In 1947, Hardin adopted the name Moondog, after a Missouri dog who often barked at the moon. Hardin as Moondog became a decades-long fixture in Midtown Manhattan as a street performer. He appeared in a modification of the dress he had debuted in North Central Arkansas, of a homemade army blanket tunic-wearing Viking, eventually wearing a horned helmet.
I do not dress as I do to attract attention. I attract attention because I dress as I do.
Pioneering Cleveland rock and roll DJ Alan Freed called his radio program the Moondog Rock and Roll Party. He also used Moondog's song, Moondog Symphony, for his background music. The real Moondog successfully sued Freed, with composer Igor Stravinsky even testifying on Hardin's behalf. In 1973, the band, led by Turkey Scratch native Levon Helm, released an album called Moondog Matinee. There was no apparent homage to fellow Arkansas-er Moondog, as Garth Hudson was the only member of the band who actually used to listen to Freed's program. A more direct quote from the rock world had come in the late 1960s when Big Brother and the Holding Company with Janis Joplin covered Moondog's song All Is Loneliness. Although he had already released a few 78 singles, Moondog's avant-garde debut album was issued in 1956. The jazz label Prestige released another pair of Moondog albums through the late 1950s. The Beat Generation especially loved his music and his anti-establishment style.
No matter where I came from, I say, no matter where I go, to me what matters is where I am on this day.
Moondog didn't record again for a dozen years until he cut a pair of albums for Columbia. By then, he had shifted emphasis from jazz to orchestral compositions and classical canons and rounds. In 1974, Moondog moved to West Germany and began to record again. By then, Moondog had played with everyone from Charles Mingus to Philip Glass and even invented several musical instruments. Jazz and classical musicians wanted to play his compositions. Myopic New Yorkers thought the street musician known as the Viking of Sixth Avenue had died. Instead, he became more well-known and prolific recording albums than in the U.S. and continued busking the streets of Europe. Moondog wrote the liner notes to his first release on his own Trimba label in 1995. For the song, You Have to Have Hope, he wrote, Bill Clinton lived in Hope and I lived in Batesville, Arkansas. We never met. I heard he played the sax, for which I wrote the piece he hasn't heard as yet. Back in Arkansas are words that fit a falling bit of melody. I'm harking back 60 years to Batesville Bess and all she did for me. As romantic as it might sound, Moondog was of course referring to his Arkansas piano teacher, Bess Maxfield. In the 1980s and 1990s, musicians like John Fahey, the Kronos Quartet, and NRBQ had covered Moondog songs. In 1997, Moondog's Sax Packs for a Sax was released on the Atlantic label. It was his first U.S. album in more than 25 years. Was also his last.
How could I fear for my last day when I am dying daily and have been since my first day?
Moondog died September 8, 1999, at age 83. His death was recognized internationally, although his Arkansas roots were seldom mentioned. A few years later, a DJ remixed version of his song Bird's Lament began to be used in commercials for SUVs. here in its entirety, is Bird's Lament by Lewis Thomas Hardin Jr., or Moondog, of Moorfield and Batesville, Arkansas. Lewis Thomas Hardin Jr., or Moondog, of Moorfield and Batesville, with Bird's Lament in memory of Charlie Parker. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook, with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of Experiment Station Studios. Producer is Keith Merks. Arkansongs, since 1998.
The 2017 Fayetteville Firefighters Hero Half Marathon is October 15th. This 13.1-mile course loops Lake Fayetteville, includes the Razorback Greenway, and ends on Dixon Street. Proceeds benefit organizations that meet community needs, increase fitness opportunities, and add value to Northwest Arkansas. Register at herohalfmarathon.com. 91.3 is supported by Highlands Oncology Group, helping patients fight the battle every day with a team of cancer specialists in both Benton and Washington counties. Services include American College of Radiology certified imaging departments, infusion centers, pharmacy, clinical trials, and more. HighlandsOncologyGroup.com.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. The Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, commonly known as DACA, will cease to exist next year. This morning, United States Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced the end of the program. He is giving Congress 6 months to formulate a plan before DACA officially expires. The program was created through an executive action signed by President Barack Obama in 2012. DACA currently shields as many as 800,000 young, unauthorized immigrants who came to the United States before age 16 from deportation. DACA provides temporary legal status. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich this morning got reaction from an Arkansas DACA recipient, and she files this report.
Zesna Garcia-Rios was brought to the U.S. from Mexico in 1992 when she was 3 years old. Garcia-Rios grew up in Northwest Arkansas. She's a 2007 graduate of Bentonville High School, Northwest Arkansas Community College in 2011, and the University of Arkansas, where the 28-year-old is now pursuing a master's in political science. She secured a teaching assistantship using her DACA credentials, which she applied for in 2012 under DACA, which can be renewed. She's able to legally drive and work. But now she says,
without DACA, I will probably lose my
my work permit, obviously. I will lose any possibility of an additional job. I will lose financial stability. I will lose any kind of ground that I have gained in the last 5 years. In the last 5 years, I've gone from working bare bones jobs of getting like maybe a couple hundred dollars here and there to getting a salaried job of over $40,000. So going from nothing to something and then going back down to nothing is going to be a big lifestyle change.
Garcia Rios took a few moments from class to talk to us. Her resume is impressive. As a teen, she volunteered in the nonprofit sector. While attending community college, she served on staff with the Cisneros Center for New Americans. Until recently, she worked for the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences in Fayetteville under the Obama-era immigration reform program. According to the nonprofit Pew Research Center, more than 787,000 youth have enrolled in DACA since 2012. Most reside in California. But according to the Migration Policy Institute, although an estimated 8,000 Arkansas youth are eligible for DACA, as many as 12,000 could qualify. And Garcia Rios says her future, until this morning, looked promising.
When I do graduate, with my master's degree in political science, I hope to continue to stay in the state of Arkansas and to advocate for families and children who need that extra voice. That's where my heart is. My heart is with my community, and my heart is with helping in any way that I can to make everyone else feel like they belong.
Sessions' announcement to end DACA is in part in response to a letter sent to him in late June by 10 state attorneys general, including Arkansas Attorney General Leslie Rutledge. The delegation had threatened to sue the Trump administration if DACA had continued. In his statement issued this morning, Sessions says Obama's executive order, quote, deliberately sought to achieve what the legislative branch specifically refused to authorize on multiple occasions. Such an open-ended circumvention of immigration laws was an unconstitutional exercise of authority by the executive branch, end quote. Fort Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
A service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Whitaker Village. We end today's show with music from Keith Nicholson. You have many chances to see him in person this week. He'll be at Aloft in Rogers tomorrow night at 7:30. Core Brewing in Bentonville Thursday night at 6. Kingfish in Fayetteville Friday night beginning at 9. Saturday in Bella Vista, at La Fajitas at 6 p.m., other spots throughout the rest of September. His full schedule at kntrio.com. Here he is, covering Los Lobos in our studio. He's singing I Got Loaded.
Last night, I got loaded on a bottle of wine. Rum, bottle of rum. Well, I feel all right.